Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Whether you're catching up on policy for a meeting or you're just that person we affectionately called the learner, you know, the one who's just insanely curious about how the world actually works, we have an incredible breakdown for you today.
Yeah, we are taking a stack of really intense policy research today and looking at the invisible architecture of our cities.
Right. So picture this. You're walking down a street in your city. You pass a vacant dirt lot, or maybe, I don't know, an abandoned commercial building. It's been sitting there for a decade. Meanwhile, everyone is screaming about a housing crisis. Rents are totally out of control. People are being priced out, and yet nothing is being built on that dirt lot.
Right. And our default narrative for this is always exactly the same. We just assume it's a lack of political will.
Yeah, we picture this smoke-filled room of corrupt politicians, or maybe just a stubborn city council digging its heels in. We think the city's engine works fine, but the driver just refuses to hit the gas.
Which is the easiest explanation, right?
Yeah.
I mean, we want to blame the individuals in charge. But when you look at the actual data and the structural reality of urban development, that narrative just completely falls apart. We aren't looking at a perfectly fine engine with a bad driver. We're looking at a machine that was meticulously designed over decades to hit the brakes.
Wow. And today we're going to show you how that braking mechanism actually works. We are diving into this fascinating piece of research titled Institutional Sclerosis and Professional Coalitions in Los Angeles Development. And I mean, the stakes really could not be higher.
No, they couldn't. Just to put this in perspective for everyone, Los Angeles currently produces roughly 15,000 housing units a year. But its actual calculated need, what the policy nerds call the regional housing needs allocation target, is around 57,000 units.
That is, wait, 15,000 against a need of 57,000. That gap is just staggering.
Exactly. Missing the mark by over 40,000 homes every single year creates this cascading affordability crisis.
And look, whether you live in LA, New York, Chicago, or really anywhere else, you've probably noticed how impossible it feels to get things built in your city. So today, we're going to show you the invisible machine that actually stops it. And to figure out why a massive, dynamic city gets stuck in the mud, we actually have to travel back in time. Not to the founding of LA, but to 1982.
Right. To look at how entire societies rise and fall. To understand the framework of this research, we have to look at an economist named Mancur Olson. So in 1982, he published this landmark book called The Rise and Decline of Nations. And Olson was trying to solve a massive historical puzzle regarding the post-World War II global economy.
Okay, so what was he looking at exactly?
Well, he looked at why the economies of post-war Germany and Japan basically skyrocketed, while a victorious, totally stable country like the United Kingdom was suffering from chronic economic stagnation at the time.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because on paper, winning a war and keeping your government intact should be, you know, the ultimate recipe for a booming economy.
Right. But Olson proposed something entirely counterintuitive. His theory was that long, stable societies naturally accumulate what he called distributional coalitions.
Distributional coalitions.
Yeah. These are narrow, highly specialized interest groups. And their primary goal isn't to create new wealth or foster new production. Their goal is simply to redistribute existing wealth to themselves.
So to use a classic economic analogy here, they aren't putting in the effort to bake a bigger pie. They are just building incredibly complex legal and procedural barriers to make sure they get the biggest possible slice of the pie that already exists on the table.
Exactly. And because Germany and Japan had their old political and social structures literally destroyed during the war, those old coalitions were wiped out. They basically had a blank slate and had to focus on sheer production just to survive.
While the UK had been politically continuous for centuries.
Right. So those narrow interest groups in the UK had decades to build up influence, pass specialized regulations, and create immense bureaucratic friction. Over time, these coalitions raise transaction costs, they slow down decision-making, they depress economic dynamism, and Olson called this terminal condition institutional sclerosis.
Man, okay, I love an analogy, so tell me if this tracks. Is this like having a smartphone that just gets slower and slower over the years? Like, the hardware isn't necessarily broken, but the phone is bogged down by dozens of background apps running in the dark.
That's exactly it.
They're constantly pinging your location, downloading updates, eating up the battery and the processing power, until eventually, I mean, it takes 10 seconds just to open a text message.
That is a brilliant way to visualize it. The background apps are the distributional coalitions. And Olson actually predicted this friction naturally concentrates around areas where local decisions touch property and capital allocation. So things like public sector compensation, government procurement, and heavily around land use.
Which brings us to the core mystery of our deep dive. Olson predicted that these background apps would form and drain the battery of the city, but he didn't predict exactly who these coalitions would be in different places. The background apps are different depending on the specific city you're in.
Exactly. And finding out who those apps are in Los Angeles is really the core achievement of this study. But to show just how weird Los Angeles is, the research first maps out the sclerosis in Chicago and New York City as reference points. Looking at Chicago really clarifies the specific architecture of a city's veto power.
Okay, let's start with Chicago, because the mechanism there is something the study calls territorial political sclerosis, combined with a severe fiscal crisis. The territorial part is the ward system.
Right. Chicago is divided into 50 wards, and each is run by an alderperson. And those 50 alderpersons have deep, almost absolute informal prerogative over zoning, permits, and licensing within their specific borders. It's essentially 50 separate mini-fiefdoms.
Wow, okay, so that's a political coalition. But the real weight dragging Chicago down is fiscal. Like, the public sector pension funds have effectively collapsed. The data points in the study are terrifying.
They really are. The Chicago police pension is only 22% funded. The fire department is at 24%. Municipal employees are just 28%.
And for context, a healthy public pension plan is supposed to be at, what, 80% or higher?
Yeah, 80% is the benchmark. So the mechanism of failure in Chicago is just a giant black hole of debt. Those unfunded liabilities force the city to constantly divert operating budget money away from city services and development just to keep the pension checks from bouncing. It basically crowds out all discretionary spending.
Right. And the result of this combined territorial and fiscal sclerosis is a shrinking city. Like, Chicago's population dropped by almost 2% between 2010 and 2023.
Right. A 1.9% drop. Now, contrast Chicago's situation with New York City. New York also has a massive housing shortage, building around 16,000 units against a 55,000-unit need. But unlike Chicago, New York isn't on the verge of bankruptcy. And before a recent post-2020 dip, the city was actually growing, like a 1.8% increase. So if they aren't broke, why can't they build?
Okay, so the mechanism in New York is labor political sclerosis. If you want to build something major in New York, you have to survive a gauntlet called ULURP, the Uniform Land Use Review Procedure.
ULURP.
Yeah, it's a highly structured, intensely political process that runs through the 51 city council members. But the coalition actually enforcing the friction isn't 50 independent ward bosses, it's massive public sector labor unions. We're talking about heavyweights like District Council 37, the United Federation of Teachers, and the Police Benevolent Association.
And the study points out a defining characteristic of New York's sclerosis here: legibility. The friction is incredibly high, sure, but it is transparent. A council member can be persuaded to approve a rezoning if they extract explicit capital commitments for their district, like a new park or a school upgrade, or if the project just guarantees union labor.
So the deals are basically made in the daylight. If you change the political math, or if a coalition of members decides the political cost of a housing shortage is finally too high, you can actually get major reform passed through public votes. And we saw this with New York's City of Yes rezoning initiative in 2024.
Exactly. Which sets the stage perfectly for Los Angeles, because Los Angeles's population is essentially flat, growing just 0.4% from 2010 to 2023, with more people actually moving out than moving in. But their pensions aren't collapsing like Chicago's. LA City employees are at 71% funded, and fire and police are at 84%.
Right, so they're in decent shape there.
Yeah. And they also don't have the same unified citywide labor coalitions controlling the zoning process like New York.
So, if LA isn't broke like Chicago, and isn't locked down by organized labor like New York, who is running the background apps, this is the headline reveal of the research. LA's sclerosis is enforced by an entirely private sector ecosystem.
Yes. The researchers term this professional procedural sclerosis. So the coalition blocking development in Los Angeles consists of environmental litigation attorneys, historic preservation consultants, EIR environmental impact report drafting firms, and specialized land use lawyers.
Wow. So the people blocking housing in Los Angeles aren't politicians trading favors in a back room. They are private sector professionals getting paid massive fees to generate endless process documents.
Exactly. And to understand why a coalition of private sector professionals is fundamentally harder to defeat than politicians or unions, we have to look at how a project actually gets approved in LA. because rather than a single political hurdle, developers face these overlapping veto layers.
Okay, let's walk through this gauntlet because this is where the theory really hits the pavement. Let's say I buy a vacant lot in Los Angeles and I want to build a 50-unit apartment building to help solve the housing crisis. What's the first wall I hit?
Well, the first major hurdle is the multi-commission charter structure and land use zoning. You have a 15-member city council that exercises incredibly strong local prerogative on land use. Plus, you have semi-autonomous commissions that all require their own reviews. But let's say you navigate the zoning and the council member is actually supportive.
Great. I have the political green light. Am I in the clear?
Not even close. Now you face CEQA, the California Environmental Quality Act. This is a state law from 1970 that courts have extended to cover almost any discretionary approval a city makes. And the mechanism of CEQA is that it allows virtually any third party to sue a project on procedural grounds, basically claiming the environmental review wasn't thorough enough.
Okay, wait, I have to push back here on behalf of anyone listening who might be feeling a little defensive right now, because if you just hear this explanation, you might think, isn't community input and environmental review fundamentally a good thing for democracy? Like, we don't want factories dumping toxins next to schools. It sounds like we're just attacking environmentalists.
I'm glad you brought that up, because that is a crucial distinction to make. The study is very careful here, and we need to be clear as well. This research is absolutely not taking a side on the underlying value of protecting the environment. It's not judging the morality of the laws at all.
Right.
It's purely analyzing the plumbing of the system. The mechanical reality is that these well-intentioned processes have been captured at the implementation layer by a consulting class.
So they operate behind a wall of technical legitimacy.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Objections are filed in the name of environmental review. But the mechanical truth is that the consultants filing those objections and the consultants hired to defend against them generate their revenue based on the friction itself persisting. I mean, they get paid by the hour to litigate the process.
Okay, so I survive the environmental lawsuit and I pay my attorneys. Next layer.
Historic preservation. LA has 35 historic preservation overlay zones, or HPOZs, which cover over 21,000 parcels. Plus, there are over 1,000 individual landmarks. And even if your vacant lot isn't historic, if it sits near one of these zones, a preservation consultant can file a challenge saying your new building disrupts historic character of the neighborhood.
And while I'm fighting the preservation consultants, I also have to deal with the neighborhood councils, right?
Oh, yeah. There are 99 chartered neighborhood councils in LA. Now, they don't have a formal legal veto to stop your building, but their mechanism is generating the official political record of opposition. They hold hearings, they pass resolutions, and then city council members use that as political cover to delay your project even further.
So, going back to my analogies, it's not a political machine making a backroom deal. It's like a toll booth on a highway. But the people running the toll booth are private consultants who are being paid by the hour to inspect every single car. They have a massive structural financial incentive to make the traffic jam as long and complicated as physically possible.
That is the perfect way to frame it. They absorb any pressure for reform by just participating in more process. They don't negotiate the substance of a building, they negotiate the paperwork. And this is exactly why LA is the hardest city to fix. Think about the accountability structure. In Chicago, if the voters get fed up, they can vote out a ward alderman. In New York, voters can shift to city council coalition.
But you cannot vote out an environmental review firm. You cannot vote out a historic preservation consultant. They aren't on the ballot.
Exactly. They face zero electoral accountability for the costs they impose on the city's housing supply. The local government is so captured by this procedural maze that even when LA's mayor, Karen Bass, issued Executive Directive 1, which, by the way, was a major local attempt to streamline affordable housing, the directive explicitly carved out the historic preservation overlay zones.
Wow.
Yeah, the very mechanism that does a huge portion of the blocking was left completely intact.
Okay, here is where it gets really interesting. If these local consultants are essentially invincible at LA City Hall and the layers of vetoes are that thick, how is anything getting built in Los Angeles at all? Because if you look at the skyline, cranes do exist.
The cranes exist because the state of California stepped in. The most productive land use reforms for Los Angeles over the last decade weren't passed in Los Angeles. They were passed in Sacramento. From 2017 to 2023, the state government produced more consequential housing reform for LA than the city produced for itself.
So they basically bypassed the local sclerosis by moving the decision-making power upstream.
Yeah. Exactly.
Sacramento shifted the venue to a place where the local LA professional coalitions have significantly less leverage.
Let's talk about the mechanics of these specific state laws, because they are fascinating workarounds. They're incredibly targeted strikes against the local toll booths. For example, Senate Bill 35 in 2017 and later SB 423. The mechanism here is establishing streamlined ministerial approval for housing that meets certain affordability targets. And ministerial is really the magic word here.
It changes the entire power dynamic.
Right. It means if a developer's project meets the objective rules on a checklist like height, density, zoning, the city must approve the permit. There is no discretionary review. There are no endless hearings, which means the local consultants cannot trigger a massive CQA environmental lawsuit because CQA only applies to discretionary decisions. It unplugs the background app entirely. Yes. And the state just kept deploying these targeted strikes. So in 2021, they passed SB 9, which attacked a different layer by allowing by-right duplexes and lot splits on most single-family parcels across the state. Then came Assembly Bill 2011 and 2022, which created by-right housing approvals along commercial corridors, literally turning dead strip malls into apartments without local interference.
And my absolute favorite example of the state playing chess against the consultants is Assembly Bill 1633 in 2023. Cities were using this trick where they would intentionally withhold a decision on an environmental review, claiming more study was needed just to bleed a developer dry. AB 1633 specifically targets that behavior. It restricts a city's ability to use a no-project delay tactic to block environmentally sound housing.
It's just a relentless barrage of state laws designed to short-circuit local processes. But it begs the question, why does Sacramento succeed where the LA City Council fails? Like, why can't the CEQA attorneys and the preservation consultants just drive up to the state capitol and lobby the legislature?
Well, it comes down to coalitional math. At the state level, the influence of a purely local LA professional coalition is massively diluted. I mean, a state senator from San Francisco or San Diego doesn't owe anything to a historic preservation consultant in Los Angeles.
Right. And furthermore, Sacramento has organized statewide counterweights that simply do not exist at the local LA City Council level. At the state capitol, the consultants have to fight the powerful building trades unions who want construction jobs. They have to fight highly organized YMBS in my backyard housing advocates, and they have to fight the governor's office, which has basically tied its political legacy to solving the housing crisis.
So what does this all mean for us? We have this incredibly sticky private sector sclerosis at the local level and a state government desperately passing laws to override it. Where does this leave us? And really, where does it leave you, the listener, sitting in your own city? According to the study, there are really only two paths forward for a city trapped by procedural gridlock.
The first path is to basically maintain the status quo. You just accept that the local political system is a permanently binding constraint, and you keep moving reform upstream to the state or even the federal level.
Which carries a massive philosophical cost. It means fundamentally ceding your local democratic agency. You are essentially admitting your city government is too broken to function, and you're asking the state capital to govern your land for you.
Right. Now, the second path is much harder locally, but it preserves democracy. It involves making the local coalitions visible. The study suggests a mechanism of disaggregating the fee flows.
Which is an academic way of saying, show the receipts.
Exactly. Force institutional disclosure. We need to see exactly who is being paid by whom for what specific process. The goal is to convert that opaque technical procedural friction into legible political bargaining. You want to make LA look a little bit more like New York City, where the deals happen in the daylight and politicians can actually be held accountable for the outcomes.
Which is a huge takeaway for you as you listen to this. Mm-hmm. Whether you're dealing with housing, transit infrastructure, or even local school board decisions, the next time you hear a local government getting bogged down in process or demanding an extended review period, you should ask yourself a very simple Olson-inspired question. Who is making money off this friction? Is there a professional coalition acting as a toll booth, charging by the hour to keep the gates closed?
Asking that question is the first step toward fixing the machine. And to connect this to the broader trajectory of where our cities are heading, the study points to economic data analyzing the preservation layer, specifically the Mills Act incidence analysis and the HCM 1200 economic study.
Wow.
Researchers looked at the massive tax subsidies flowing to properties that are already deemed historic, essentially paying wealthy owners to keep their buildings frozen in amber.
Wow.
And it points to a really profound, honestly chilling, long-term consequence.
What happens at the end of the road?
Well, we naturally think of sclerosis as leading to a dramatic, highly visible collapse. We picture a rusting bridge suddenly falling into a river, or a city going bankrupt overnight, like Detroit did in the 2010s. But based on Olson's theory, and this specific data on preservation subsidies, what if the ultimate fate of a highly sclerotic city isn't a dramatic crash at all? What if it's a quiet freezing in time?
Oh, man.
Imagine a city that slowly becomes a perfectly preserved, beautifully maintained museum. It's heavily subsidized by the state. It's meticulously managed by elite consultants. But it's completely devoid of the messy, dynamic, growing middle-class life that actually built the city in the first place. This raises a vital question for all of us. Is the real danger facing our great cities not destruction, but absolute permanent stagnation?
A perfectly preserved machine sitting completely still in the dark. That is a heavy thought to leave on, but an incredibly important one. Thank you for taking this deep dive with us. Keep questioning the structures around you. Look for the invisible machines operating in your own city, and we will see you next time.